What's up, people? Welcome to Rebranding Safety, episode 16, Noise at Work. As you probably picked up in the last podcast episode, we've got our first guest, Stephen Melvin. So it's quite a long podcast. We're going to get straight into it. But just quickly, make sure you listen to the end. There is a little bonus subject on diversity or lack of diversity in the health and safety industry. Let's get into the podcast.
Health and safety is almost a victim of its own success.
Weird and oppressive regime of health and safety regulations.
A huge fire engulfs a tower block in London.
Children being forced to wear goggles to play conkers at school.
Worst oil field disaster, 164 dead.
Rebranding Safety, the modern health and safety podcast, crushing the stereotype. Brought to you by Risk Fluent and your host, James McPherson. So today in the podcast, we've got Stephen Melvin, hails out of Corby in Northamptonshire, local to the podcast, earning stripes in previously in retail logistics and now food manufacturing, also a blogger. So Stephen, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Blogger is a rather grandiose term for that one fantastic article and very well received article. But yeah, it's something I enjoy doing. I have got more planned, but safety's just getting in the way. Safety and parenting is getting in the way at the minute. So
parenting.
They're on the back burner.
What's it like being a safety professional and a parent? Are you over the top? Are you more conscious?
I say this to everyone. It's occupational safety that I deal with. So if he's running around with scissors, that's on his head. He needs to learn.
Fair enough. Like it. So today we're going to talk about noise at work then. Noise at work, personally for me, I don't know if you listened to the last podcast, but I'm actually hard of hearing.
Yes, yeah, so I did.
I'm just like fully deaf and I couldn't put it down to anything specific. But I think when I was in college, I was aiming to work in theatre. So I did quite a lot like gigs and sound engineering and stuff like that.
Okay.
And you used to put like your ear right up to the speakers, see if you can hear clicking. Which apparently was a good idea. And I think that's where it came from, because it was always my right ear that I put up to it, and it's my right ear that's took most of the damage.
Yeah, I'd say that's definitely linked.
Yeah, I think so. And then moving into manufacturing as well, we used to have some of the stuff in the control measures that we'll talk about in a bit. But I can't sue the company that I used to work for, because it's a really good friend of mine. Used to work for him. He's a really good friend of mine, and I wouldn't want to sue him. But I never even thought about it. But when I think, do you know what I could do with a holiday? I think if I sue someone for my hearing, then
it's a good ace to have in your back pocket, isn't it? That one.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm over the 3-year gap. I think I was diagnosed about 3.5 years ago, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
Anyway, so
missed that boat.
On my kind of research, then I found out that like noise at work liability claims cost the NHS around $500 million per annum, which I thought was just absolutely nuts.
Well, it's a lot of money for that. That links into a lot of other areas of safety that aren't sort of managed properly. You see the stats come out from the HSE every year, where they start talking about what safety's costing and what. You think, well, potentially we could save as safety professionals. It's quite a scary amount when you see it. You see it there, isn't it?
Yeah, and then it costs the economy like 5 to 7 billion per annum as well. It's just nuts. Like we could do with that money, really.
I know, it's it's an unfathomable amount of money, isn't it?
Crazy. And for some of this, I think most stuff is quite easy to manage, but I think noise is quite easy to manage.
Yeah.
But then as well, 1 million workers in the UK exposed to injurious noise levels. So that's just nuts. That's crazy.
I found that out. I did a sort of presentation for our factory management team on noise, which we'll talk about in a little while, I imagine. And that was a stat that I came across that I thought that's just like ridiculous numbers again. I think when you start getting into sort of tens and hundreds of thousands, that's when figures start sort of losing sort of appeal to people, because they're hard to sort of work out and sort of make sense of. So then when you start getting into millions and billions, it's just like normal people can't comprehend those sort of those numbers. So seeing it like that, it's like Wow.
Yeah. Joe, it would be good, actually. I'm nowhere near good enough with money and numbers, but it would be interesting to see, like, the 5 to 7 billion per annum it costs the economy, what that is, and Joe Bloggs in our wallet.
Yeah.
Is that 2p, 3p, 50p, £2?
Yeah.
That would be interesting. I don't think we could do that, but...
No.
Excuse me. So, the regulations around control of noise is the control of noise at work regulation 2005, the noise regs essentially. And when I was just double checking stuff on that, you know, again, as per everything, Stephen, I find it quite simple. It essentially says the same, in my opinion, as the Health and Safety at Work Act, which is just like assess risk and take action on the risk. And that essentially, that was it for me.
Yeah, it's like the Riddle one last week. It's quite prescriptive. It only comes in if you have a reportable accident, or now these noise regs only come in if you've got injurious levels of noise, which is black and white, to be honest. Like people say, and we were discussing before you start recording, some areas can be grey, but it's how it's worded, whereas this is quite sort of black and white. If it's over a certain level, you've got action to take, and then there's a couple of points then that fall in. So it's a nice, easy one. It's quite simply worded, I thought, as well. It doesn't take too much dissecting to get to what you need to do, which is a nice change. I think some safety legislation does get a bit complicated. It's like, why?
It's very wordy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like, why use 10 words when 100 words will do?
I see, and the point of the podcast is kind of just take all that important stuff out. But if I'm honest, the HSE guides does that. In my opinion. Did you use their guides a lot, or...?
I do. What I'll do is I'll go to the regs first and see what I can decide for myself. If it's some of the things like we're talking about, noise, riddle, vibration, those sort of things don't require a huge amount of sort of dissection. They're quite black and white. The ones where it's a bit more sort of nuanced and wordy, we'll hit the guidance and sort of see what the examples are and things like that. Or if it's an area that I'm not sort of vastly experienced in, then I'll go to the guidance as well and sort of get some support from that and do the research that way.
And talking to the HSE guidance centre, I mean, in their guidance, they basically just say assess, take action, provide hearing protection, make sure you don't breach the legal limits, which we'll touch on in a minute, provide information, instruction and training, carry out health surveillance where there's a risk to health. And for me, that's pretty simple. I suppose the bit people don't know is the legal limit, unless you went and found it, you wouldn't be aware of it. So I suppose, I don't know for you, but like when working in a business, if you own a small manufacturing unit, you know, when's the point do you get to when you think, actually, this might be a bit loud?
I think it's, do you know when you go on a night out? No, I'm not about to do that much anymore. but when you're younger and you come back from a night out and you have that ringing in your ears.
Yeah.
That, and you'd sort of think, that's annoying, because it'd affect you. Sort of, if you went out on a Friday, it'd be the whole weekend, your ears would be ringing, and then it'd sort of be back normal for Monday. I think if you were doing that and just never getting over it, you think, well, something's up here.
Yeah.
This has got to be work that's doing this to me. And I think that's when you'd start looking at it. But a lot of the old school approach to those sort of industries, engineering, manufacturing, they'll be sort of set up in a little shed somewhere. And they'll have their sort of machines running at full pelt all day. It's noisy. The guys are in their sort of 50s, 60s, probably in their 70s in some cases, and have worked in that industry their whole life. They'll have fingers missing or parts of fingers missing. They'll sort of be hard of hearing. I think that's the sort of classic British engineer, isn't it? That sort of... That's what they'd be like.
That's an interesting point, actually. I wonder with clubs and stuff, I wonder, do they even think about stuff like that? Interesting.
I wouldn't have thought so at all. The only person I think that would think about it is the DJ.
Maybe, yeah.
I think they're
in my experience, DJs want to put louder, as loud as they can go.
Yeah. It's a 2 meter rule, so if you can't have a conversation with someone from 2 meters, you know you've got sort of to look at your noise issue. So when you're sort of right up in someone's ear, shouting in it.
Yeah.
It's not. I think that's the sort of levels when you should start looking at it.
Yeah, for sure. So I suppose then what we're kind of talking about, the noise levels, and for anyone that doesn't know, it's measured in decibels, and you'll probably know this inside out, Stephen, with your kind of workplace. And then you've got the weight measurement of A's and C's, which is basically average and peak, from the easiest way to explain it.
Yeah.
So when I was looking through it, you know, the exposure of noise of your employees averaged over a week or day, they give you levels basically. So there's a lower exposure limit, action value. So daily or weekly, which would be your A, it's 80 decibels. And then your peak, which would be your C, is 135 decibels. So that's why 135 is quite a lot of decibels. It's quite loud.
Yeah, you'd know that's going on around you.
For sure. I mean, 130 decibels is a jet taking off.
Yeah, and you see the guys down when they're doing the waving of the things. They've got some nice big cans on, haven't they? So yeah, luckily for them.
So I mean, that's a loud noise. I from my experience in manufacturing, I don't think we ever hit anything like that. Even our peaks were nowhere near that. I think we were coming in at around 80, which is why we took some steps. But and then, I mean, you go up to your upper exposure limit, you're hitting 85 and 137, so there's only 5 decibels added to the lower, and then my maths has gone now. two decibels. It's early on a Sunday morning, give me a break. how did you go about kind of within your manufacturing kind of unit, and was it already highlighted when you started there that there was a noise issue, or did you highlight it when you started?
Yeah, it's quite a sort of mature business there, sort of 30 years old where I'm working currently. So yeah, we're a food manufacturer, and there was noise assessment in place when I started there. Hearing protection is mandatory throughout the factory and a couple of other areas, sort of the boiler room. We've got some plant outside as well that need it. So we knew it was our biggest exposure, sort of the business were sort of aware of that. So we give everyone earplugs. That's how we're sort of managing that day to day. So yeah, when I started though, we did the assessment. There was a few of the findings that was a bit, flagged up a few concerns with me and some of the reading. So we redid that tail end of last year. We did that ourselves. I did that myself. I've done noise assessments in the past, spot readings, and developed sort of control measures out of that. So we bought a new noise meter, sound level meter, and sort of had it all calibrated, etc. So yeah, I went out into the factory. Our operation's pretty steady day to day with what they run. So the same number of machines tend to run every day. Yeah. So the noise levels are quite consistent. So we took the readings. I've got sort of machines shut off in sort of areas where they might, at one point at peak, we've got a room that's got 4 of the same machine in it, and that's one of our sort of higher risk areas. So we did the readings with 1, 2, 3, and 4 machines running, just to make sure that we had plenty of data to work with, make sure we're getting the right measures in place for controlling the noise. One of the good things about our building, it's not a wide open shed, so the noise isn't carrying sort of hundreds of meters down the factory. They're all in sort of self-contained rooms, got nice high ceilings as well, so noise sort of dissipates, which is quite good. But like I said, noise protection is mandatory in the factory, so it's the earplugs. We've got 2 areas where the readings were over 105, about 105 107, so this is where we have ear defenders are worn in those areas. So higher rating than the plugs, and just sort of the people that are based in there have to wear them all day.
So they're like the cans, the big ones.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, like you'd see the people on the runways wearing. So, and we'll talk about how they're rated a little bit later. But so yeah, the guys that are based in there wear them all the time. The earplugs, the rating they've got, people that are going in and out are sort of all right to wear them for just sort of visiting or sort of dropping in ingredients, etc.
So do you do them assessments? Sorry, do you do them assessments yourself? You say you got a decibel meter, so do you get consulting in? You do them within your business?
No, I've worked with people in the past that have had sort of sound professionals in on sort of the doing the full sound and noise risk assessment. And the readings aren't too dissimilar to what I've done doing spot readings as well. One of the useful things about them is they tell you how sort of the noise moves around the premises. Mm. And I think if you're having sort of ongoing health issues, a full assessment like that would be necessary.
Yeah.
But I think if you're controlling it and you're sort of doing your health surveillance and you're not having any issues, it's not getting flagged up as your control measures are working.
Yeah.
I think we're sort of all right at the moment. I think if we went down the route that, yeah, the health surveillance started saying, oh, you're having these issues, I think that's when you'd get sort of one of the sort of more professional or sort of focused on the noise would be, would be when it'd be relevant for
us. Kind of do it like a tiered approach kind of thing. I like that. I like that.
Yeah. And noise assessments aren't cheap either to get the sort of professionals in. It's a big project and a big sort of cost. So, so this is definitely the first step. I think most businesses would need to or should do rather than just going out and sort of spending thousands of pounds and then getting back a report that they can't make head nor tail of because there's so many sort of equations and stuff.
It's
they're not the easiest to read. Even the summaries, which I think most people would just tend to read to sort of get a rough idea what they need to do, they're still sort of mind-blowing.
Yeah, for sure. I think you touched on it a minute ago about if you've got your own decibel meters, I suppose there's a cost there of keeping that calibrated. So how do you do that? Do you get that sent away somewhere?
Yeah, the company that we bought it from do the calibrations as well. It's an annual calibration. It'd probably be this risk assessment, we wouldn't review it more than probably every few years. And that's just because I think once you start getting that far, it's good to have a look at things, how processes changes overall with risk assessments. But with noise, if we got a new bit of kit in, we do it then because we need to see how it affects the rest of the room and the rest of the operation that it's in. But yeah, sort of getting it calibrated before it's used, we would do. Otherwise it'd just be it could be a useless bit of kit. We don't know sort of how what the lifetime of the product is, to be honest. That's what we do with that one.
Nice one. So, you know, essentially if you got that decibel meter, which is obviously a cost, and keeping it calibrated is obviously a cost, but then if you've got kind of, I suppose it depends on the size and of your undertaking, your operation, everything, but it's quite reasonable to expect a business owner to be able to do that within their business themselves, like you're doing, you know, especially if they've got a health and safety professional. I suppose that professional could do it themselves, like you're saying. I mean, what my previous experience working in manufacturing, we did exactly the same as what you're doing. You know, we had our own decibel meter, we did regular monitoring of that, we did health surveillance, etc. And then from there, you know, we would just work quite closely with HR, who would highlight any kind of changes in the health surveillance and stuff like that. So I suppose a relationship with HR is quite important when health surveillance comes in, if you've got a HR department, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely. It's those two go hand in hand, don't they? HR, Occi Health, health and safety, all that sort of thing. We've got a good relationship with HR. I think it's good as a health and safety professional to have a good relationship with everyone. Otherwise, you are the stereotypical guy that sits in the IOSH meetings that we see hundreds of people, like clones of each other.
Everyone's mate.
That's it, with their clipboards. I think building the relationships one of the most important things with safety. Because people listen to you if you're sort of even just semi-likable and not sort of stopping them from doing their job. They're getting pressure from people. The last thing they need is you coming up and sort of adding to that pressure.
So I suppose we just talked to them about the assessment essentially and just kind of working out if we've got a problem around noise, if we have got a problem, what that problem is. And just to quickly jump back over the values. So the lower exposure is 80, the peak sound is 135, and then the upper is 80. But then we've also got legal limits, so really stuff that you must not legally exceed. So 87 and 140. And it sounds like actually, Stephen, you had quite high levels at your thing, so that must be on your radar quite heavily, those limits.
Definitely. So I think the sort of limits I've been aware of since sort of doing my Nebosch general back in 2011, it had been. So yeah, I've always known the sort of limits and what we need to be working to, the sort of the peaks in the troughs of the noise. Yeah, it's hard to sort of control them all the time, or sort of what other issues can we introduce, or other controls can we introduce, rather than just hearing protection. Mm-hmm. 'Cause that's the sort of simple way of doing it, isn't it? Give everyone earplugs, sure. Give everyone ear defenders. You can't, without looking at the sort of the root cause of the problem, which is what as safety professionals we really should want to be sort of dealing with whenever we have sort of something like this. Due to the operation, we have putting in sort of people need access to the machinery. There's nothing we can really do about that. They need to be getting in there, putting in mixes, putting in ingredients. Yeah.
So segregation's kind of out the window.
Yeah, out the window. We can't do that. A lot of the equipment is sort of, we have sort of covers for it that go over when sort of the final mix is, everything's in, and then it's getting mixed up, and sort of they're left to run for a certain amount of time. But yeah, when they're putting in the ingredients, that's when they're sort of exposed to the highest sort of peaks of the noise then. Due to it being a food production site as well, sound absorption, sort of up on the walls, things like that, is sort of not a feasible option either.
For like hygiene.
Yeah, so we need to keep quite a sterile site. So everything that goes into the factory is sort of ran past our QA and technical team as well. So having a good relation, like we said before, about having a good relationship with HR, we need to have a good relationship with a team that are running the food safety side of things as well. And that's the sort of big team that have quite a lot of sway, rightly so. They're keeping the sort of product safe and making sure that what goes out is meeting the food manufacturing laws and food safety standards. Because without that, we wouldn't have much of a business going forward. So they're doing sort of great work to keep us compliant there. So yeah, we need to make sure that everything that goes into the factory they're happy with. It needs to be of a certain standard as well. Needs to be sort of a lot of the time metal detectable, non-perishable. So yeah, it's quite hard sometimes finding. It's not just a case of nipping down to sort of the local work equipment provider and buying a set of gloves or a set of cans. They need to be a sort of certain spec to meet our requirement as well. So that's always good fun.
Wow. So I suppose maintenance of the machines is quite a big thing for you, from obviously from a hygiene point of view, but I suppose just general good maintenance of a machine can dramatically reduce noise levels.
Yeah.
So I suppose for you, is that one of your biggest control measures or your most impactful control measures?
Yeah, we've got a PPM that runs regularly. So we've got an engineering team that's about, I think there's about 22 engineering engineers. That run sort of work constantly. So it's a 24/7 operation that we have, and we've got engineer cover for all of that. So yeah, they're sort of in there responding to sort of doing reactive maintenance as well as required to keep the sort of product going out the door. But yeah, also sort of doing the planned in stuff as well. So stripping down lines, sort of refurbing them from scratch, that's sort of ongoing for the guys. And yeah, like you say, keeping the equipment running well, even just simple things like keeping them greased up as they need to be, can sort of take away some of the noise there. So it's sort of a multi-pronged attack on noise. One of the problems, like you're saying about it being a sterile environment, there's just nothing there to absorb the noise in certain rooms, so that doesn't help. When you've got sort of some quite big name clients that come in and do regular inspections, and they're looking at sort of hygiene, they're looking at sort of safety standards now, a lot of the ethical audits are coming in and sort of looking at how the staff are treated, as well as sort of the production side of things. You've got a lot of factors there that you need to consider when you're putting in any control measure, not just for the noise.
So that you can get noise absorption pads and stuff to sit on like feet of machinery and stuff. I suppose is that out the window as well for you as well
from a high. Yeah, fortunately, because the machines are probably weigh well over a ton, some of them. Wow. So getting them pads up to clean them regularly would be a
impossible.
Big, impossible job to do. It wouldn't be sort of feasible for us to have a crane in there lifting equipment every night, because it's every night the equipment's turned off, stripped down, and sort of cleaned, ready for the next morning. Doing that, it'd just sort of be impossible for us to do.
Yeah. So do you have like quiet zones, like lunch area and stuff like that? It's completely separate from the manufacturing. Again, obviously, probably for hygiene reasons, but from a noise point of view, they call it like refuges, don't they?
Yeah. The canteen, so all the rest areas are outside of the factory, so it's double door. They've got a sort of boot wash, hand washing station to go through. And then they'll be in sort of the canteen and sort of changing rooms, and they can go out and sort of smoke if they want to. It's all sort of separate. There's no sort of external noise problems, sort of everything's contained within the building. So people can get away from the noise when they need to throughout the day.
So I suppose the kind of the most common control measures that we've just kind of gone over is like maintenance, segregation, things like barriers and walls. But obviously that's a problem for yourself. Refuges, noise absorption, kind of pads and padding and stuff like that. PPE, buy quiet policy. I don't suppose like for tools, maybe from your engineering point of view, I suppose it would be like a drop in the ocean, really, I suppose, to have a noisy drill in your area. But
Yes, the equipment when they're out doing the sort of using any sort of power tools, you can't, in some areas you can't even hear the drill going. Because they've got the PPE in place, and sort of because of the noise we already have, that's not something that we sort of looked at doing, sort of those sort of reduced noise tools or anything like that.
I suppose having a good relationship as well with staff, or not relationship, maybe like communication back and forth, staff feeling comfortable to say, do you know what, I went home last night and my ears were ringing and stuff like that, to essentially highlight risks or highlight hazards and stuff like that. That's quite important as well, I would assume.
Yeah, sort of communication is probably the most difficult part of safety, isn't it? It's doing the reviews of legislation, risk assessments, writing an SOP or safe system of work and getting out, that's easy. I can sort of do that all day if left to it. But getting the relevant information to your operatives and management team and giving them the information they need and support they need, sort of a challenge day to day. Working in a sort of production environment as well, you've got sort of multiple countries represented there. So people with different levels of English. I can only speak English. I've not got any other languages under my belt, unfortunately. It is sort of hard making people aware of what they need to do, but keeping it clear and concise. We do regular sort of toolbox talks. Because the noise is such an issue, people are aware to sort of raise any issues they're having with their PPE, or if they're having issues with the hearing as well, to raise it to their sort of team leader or area manager, whoever it may be, and or me when I'm out and about on the shop floor. I like getting out and sort of I like getting away from a desk and sort of going out and talking to people about safety. So a lot of people at our work sort of aren't shy about coming to you, so which is good. You sort of hear about issues people are having, either through a colleague that they're close with, or if they're sort of more shy, they will sort of raise it with someone who they know will pick it up with us. Sort of committee members, we've got sort of a good committee out on our sort of operation as well, which is good. So a lot of issues will sort of get raised through the committee as well. Giving them that support is probably one of the most important things. I think getting back to people as well is an ongoing challenge with when they're reporting their misses or issues they might have. Getting back to them in a timely way is something that I'm constantly pushing myself to sort of do better. So letting them know that they're not just sort of throwing what their sort of near misses into a big health and safety hole that's never going to get looked at is sort of important.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's something I always found was important, you know, that kind of closure for the shop floor staff. Yeah, that's a good point. So you mentioned PPE is quite a heavy part of your kind of control measures. So
yes,
I always found it's a couple of things. One, it's really scary how many people don't have a clue how to put earplugs into their ear.
Yeah, I think I learned that on my NeBosch course again. So before that, I'd wear them if it was like I was at a sort of festival or something. If it was noisy, I put them in to sleep. But then the difference between putting them in properly to just pushing them in your ear is like night and day.
Yeah,
I think it's scary how many people are unaware, like, how life-changing hearing damage can be and will willfully not wear their hearing protection properly.
Yeah, yeah. And do you know what? To take it from me, I mean, I've only, I think mine is 46 or 47% across both ears, my hearing loss.
Right.
Means I have to wear a hearing aid, but even with a hearing aid in one ear, you know, if for example, yesterday I was watching the Six Nations in the pub, so I really have to concentrate if someone's talking, if there's that a lot of background noise. Yeah. It varies as well, and everyone's different with hearing loss, but personally for me, it's different tones of voice. So women I struggle with more, and young people, because their voices are naturally higher pitch. And it's the higher pitches I've lost. Now, you could have lost the low pitches as well. You know, it depends on you and the incident and whatever. But it does dramatically impact your life. It really does. And you really wouldn't think it.
Yeah.
You know, from having subtitles on this TV. You know, personally, for me, I was, because my mum's completely deaf, I was used to having them. You know, my brother's got perfect hearing, but he has subtitles on as well. Because we were just so used to it. So when I found out later in life, so about, I think I was about 20, I must have been about 24, I think, when I found out I lost my hearing, I was used to having subtitles anyway, so it's easy. But if you're not, it's really distracting. Yeah. It's also sometimes I find it can be a bit embarrassing. Sometimes people come around and you've got subtitles on. You know, it's an interesting thing. And like you say, people don't realise the damage and the effect it has. And it is a big effect. And if you go the whole way, you know, I have had the privilege of playing rugby for England Deaf, and they've got some people in that team that are profoundly deaf. And obviously, when you get profoundly deaf, that affects how you speak, because you can't hear yourself speaking for obvious things. And you know, it could be the point where you need to learn a new language. You know, you've got to learn sign language. There's so much things that it can affect you. It's unbelievable. One of the interesting story, my father-in-law was had to have quite a big operation. He was staying in a hospital not so long ago, and he was complaining that it was so noisy. So his wife brought him some earplugs, and I went round, and we went round to see him, and just came up in conversation how noisy it was. And his wife said, have you put the earplugs in? He said, yeah, they didn't do it. I said, Tim, how are you putting in, just out of curiosity? And he said, I just put them in my ear. And I said, no. He said, roll them up in between your fingers, so they're real, like, tiny point. Lift your earlobe up and push it in your ear. And he was like, oh, what's that do then? I was like, it puts them in your ear properly. Two puts them in, and then the next time. Them. Yeah, and the next time we saw him, he said, it made so much difference. So, you know, that's just one or two nights in a hospital. You know, imagine the difference that would make in kind of your environment, or any kind of manufacturing or construction environment. It's really easy with the cans. You just put them on your head. But with the earplugs, you know, they're supposed to be more comfortable. They're supposed to be easier and stuff like that. But, you know, putting them in, if you don't do it right. Other things I've seen, people cut the ends off. I don't know if you've come across this, but
I've not seen that one, no.
Yeah, people that don't like wearing them, I've seen them cut the ends off and just sit the end in their ear so that it looks like you're wearing them. The trick is, what you do is you go over to people and say, can you just shake your head to the side like that? And then they fall out. It's crazy.
Mental that you'd risk it.
Yeah, for sure. So the aim with hearing protection then is to get it to less than 85 decibels at the ear. So when buying hearing protection, I suppose you by the sounds of it, you must do this quite a lot. And it talks about a few things, like attenuation, single number rating system, so SNRs, and HMOs as well. So I don't know if you feel free, if you want to jump in here and try and through it, Steve, since you buy them quite a lot.
Yeah, so yeah, the SNR was probably the most important thing and sort of one of the key things I've learned going through this sort of noise exposure issue, is that it's not just a case of all hearing protection is equal. There are sort of different ratings, and sort of they can be quite a significant sort of jump between two products that look exactly the same, sort of a set of earplugs. The foam ones can be massively different to sort of, you know, the blue ones that have got the different three different flanges on. You'd think earplugs are earplugs, ear defenders are ear defenders, but yeah, they can be massively different. So I think just buying one pair of cans off the shelf is not a good approach. You've got to, as part of your assessment, identify what level of SNR is required, which we've done in our which I've done in our risk assessment to sort of put in place. So this, for this area, we need this SNR rating. For this area, this is what's needed. So we do it by, we've got three different types of hearing protection. We've got the plugs, which are SNR 30 something. We've got the set of yellow cans, and then we've got a set of green cans as well, so we know each area what they need to be wearing and and when. So so yeah, it's quite a good, it's quite a simple number to work with as well. You take that number, the SNR, off of the spot reading you've taken, and if it's less than sort of 85 or 80, you're good to go. But yeah, on the one at work, it's got the spot reading in the frying hall is, what would it be, 97, something like that. The SNR rating of hearing protection to be worn in this area is sort of 22 or 22 to 30, something like that, going off the guidance. So so yeah, it's a nice simple way to sort of to do it. Like you were saying earlier, noise is quite simple to manage as long as you've got the right data, and you use the sort of the numbers on the products that you're buying.
So correctly. you take the to, for the sake of the listeners, and you take the kind of the number of decibels you've got currently in the room, and correct me if I'm wrong, Stephen, and then you minus the SNR from that, which would give you the decibels that it hits the ear at. So
that's,
if you've got like 99 decibels in the room and your SNR is 19, you would minus 19 from 99, and that'll bring it down to 80, for example.
That's right, yeah. And some of the guidance I read, it wasn't just on sort of HSE, it went sort of a little bit deeper. And it said they take off another few decibels just for people not wearing it correctly as well. So
that's a great idea.
Yeah, so especially with sort of earplugs, like saying, you can get lots of people that will not put them in right, or they might just not get their cans over their ear properly. So there is going to be that sort of leakage as well. So having something that's a bit over or takes you sort of maybe to 74, something like that, wouldn't be a bad thing. If that's what the SNR would take you to. But then there's always the case of, if you are going over, you can't go too far over because people might not hear your fire alarm or other emergency sort of alarms that are going on, or they can start feeling isolated and sort of just in their own little world, which you don't want people to be sort of feeling like that in the workplace. You want them to be sort of involved, and if they're sort of feeling that as soon as they put these ear defenders on, it's like they can't hear anything. Then that's another issue you're going to have to start sort of working measures into further down the line, isn't it?
Yeah. So this is HML. So bear in mind, HML is really complicated. It stands for high, medium, and low. So does that come into it much? So they're high, medium, and low frequencies. Does that come into the purchasing of it much, or do you mention the frequencies that much?
Not really. I think that's the sort of thing that, like we touched on earlier, the sort of the higher level noise assessment would start picking up those frequencies. So if it's when we get the noise surveillance done next, then we see there might be, if there's any action areas that will sort of common areas we need to look at, it's probably the frequencies then you'd start looking at, I'd imagine, with what you need to, what additional control measures you need to start looking at. But yeah, I've not had much, thankfully, on that, because noise is confusing. the noise of how it works, how it moves and things like that, it's quite sort of hard to get my head around.
I'm conscious that I didn't actually explain what attenuation means, but attenuation is that kind of the process of losing noise energy. That's what attenuation is. So really, when you're looking at your SNRs, your HORs and your protection and stuff like that, what you're trying to do is create attenuation there. So I suppose from a base level, and obviously your kind of industry is quite high end, high impact noise. It's high level noise, essentially. But for most people, I think it'd be quite a simple solution. You know, it's kind of getting a decibel meter or paying someone to give you a real simple assessment. What's the decibel number minus the SMRs, and then boom, we've got there. You know, and it might not even be that you need to get that hearing protection. They might be able, just by maintenance or something like that, to drop that noise level down without even needing PPE. I suppose a good point that I've always found interesting and also found quite difficult when I was in manufacturing was that the guidance kind of pulled you away from that blanket approach, and they asked you to try and specifically target things. And I always found in manufacturing, Stephen, and maybe you're the same, that that was quite a difficult thing to sell to the management team, that they would rather, we said it, let's put it into context, we kind of had a collection of five buildings that were connected together and you could walk through them all. One was offices, one was warehouses, one, and then the last three were manufacturing. Once you got to that third, the last three, that was it, hearing protection mandatory throughout the whole thing. Even though on the pathways, which were at the edge of the building, when we measured the pathway walking from the door to the other door, for example, you never hit any of the lower exposure limits anyway, so we never got anywhere near 80 decibels. So actually my argument was, we don't need it, and I think we're creating that kind of negative approach. And if people don't wear them, because we were watching, unfortunately this path was basically the way into the whole factory, so you get office staff go in through the factory and then walk up to the office. They would come in, not put the hearing protection in and just walk through, and I was saying, just by doing that, it's creating that, well, I've been doing that for years and I've never got hearing loss. So I think that's the benefit of not having a blanket approach. But then from a business point of view and monitoring and stuff like that, it can be quite difficult to target things, or in their opinion, it was quite difficult. How do you find that?
Yeah, blanket approach is sort of quite difficult, especially when we do have sort of 300 people on site that do require hearing protection. It's difficult when you've got 300 plus people on site who do require hearing protection. The operation requires it in all levels, to just sort of go, right, everyone gets earplugs, then that's the problem solved. I think by breaking down our risk assessment to the different areas and sort of looking at what SNRs required in the hearing protection, we've sort of tweaked it so it's specific for each area. It's not just a case of, our highest reading is 105. Everyone gets the top spec ear defender, no matter what area it is, even if they're sort of working at 86 sort of decibels. Sometimes it can be the culture, though. If you sort of say, right, when you're walking around this area, you don't have to wear your hearing protection. Next thing you know, people are walking around that part of your building and into their job, where they might be sort of welding or whatever, and then they're just not putting their hearing protection on, or they think, oh, I forgot my hearing protection, I've got to go back to my locker to get it and then go back. So it's sort of, it can impact on productivity. Sometimes just having that sort of control can be a sort of, it's a fine balance in line, isn't it? That this sort of culture thing. And it's a hard thing to quantify as well. So lots of people talk about having a sort of safety culture, and sort of wearing the PPE at the right points would fall into that, definitely. But yeah, sometimes the blanket approach can be easier for managing one area, which tweaking it a little bit, like we've done with sort of having the three different types of hearing protection for the operation, is definitely a good way of making sure everyone's protected, making sure people can get to the areas they work in without being exposed, and it isn't sort of just a case of us, let's just go all in, highest rate, and everyone gets that, and then we can forget about it, sort of thing. It's has been, each area has been sort of picked for its little subtle nuances, I think, and it's it's a sort of a semi-blanket approach, I think, we've gone for. Gosh. Rather than just sort of giving everyone the same thing.
But you've kind of thought about it, I suppose, and that's what the guidance is asking to do, essentially, isn't it? But culture, yes, is a good point, I suppose. I think that's a very good point. I think culture is massive whenever you're using PPE as heavily as what, you know, somewhere like your factory would be. Yeah. Culture is absolutely huge. I think, like you said earlier, that kind of multi-tonged approach of hitting noise, I think with culture, it's the multi-tonged approach of hitting noise and a multi-tonged approach of hitting slips and trips and a multi-tonged approach of hitting... And that kind of all those little things. And then we go to the non-safety specific stuff as, you know, kind of like leadership and stuff like that. You know, it's so difficult and to actually get culture right, I think. And I think essentially what it comes down to is loving your job. I think somebody made a good point when I was in a conversation with a friend of mine earlier, and they were saying, you know, what you find people that say have a job in, I don't know, climbing mountains, for example, that's their job, right? They take safety really seriously. Well, why? Well, because the severity is so bad, you know, it goes wrong, fall off a mountain, dead, simple as. And they said, but why does everybody still do it? And as we were talking about it, and I was like, you know, I think it comes down to the fact that they love what they do.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're doing their hobby. So, and their hobby is climbing, and part of that is wearing a harness or doing whatever. And because they love what they do, they don't want to die and they want to carry on doing it.
Yeah.
And I suppose culture, part of that is about, I always call it like a family kind of feel. You know, you find if you go to a business and they all treat each other, they all call themselves family. I always find it's a much safer environment because naturally they protect each other.
Yeah,
but definitely. It's just culture is something that a lot of people throw around as a word, like, yeah, you know, we need to think about culture, we need to change the culture. And I think, do you actually get a full grasp of what culture is?
Yeah,
it's huge, it's huge,
and it's impossible to measure the culture as well. So, it's like you say, it's more of a feeling, isn't it? When you get that, you walk into a workplace, it's sort of clean, tidy. You can see people sort of having a sort of a laugh and a joke with each other. I think the safety culture should fit in with the sort of full business culture. So it shouldn't just be a case of sort of we put shitloads of pressure on the company to get the product out the door. And everyone hates sort of doing their job because they can't have a laugh with their sort of workmates until it's break time. They're just sort of constantly feeling pressure. But we act on all our near misses. We've got sort of wet floor signs if there's a spill and people act on it straight away. All our training's up to date. I think it's sort of everything should be sort of hand in hand. I think you said about it on one of the previous podcasts that sort of safety shouldn't just be sort of first priority. It should just be thought about in the bigger picture of things. Like it should be part of whatever project you're working on, whatever you're doing day to day. It should just be another factor you think of. It doesn't have to be first if you're thinking about it. Just because you've wrote it down first on your meeting minutes doesn't really mean that you're a proactive safety culture. It could just mean that you're getting it out the way first.
Yeah, sure.
So, it's that sort of having it all in the same melting pot is important. I think, the culture side of things, just having a good safety culture isn't I don't even know, like, there's no way of measuring it.
I suppose in theory, if you had a good it's difficult to manage culture specifically, but if you have in theory a good culture, then your lagging indicators, like your accidents, your near misses should tend, well, your near misses would probably go up, but your accidents should probably come down in theory. Trying to find out the root cause of your accidents coming down, is that your culture or is that something else you've done? But then you could argue that, well, the stuff that we've done that brought accidents down is because we've got a good culture. But I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
But I think it's about just kind of that. Take a step back and look at the business as a whole and how does it feel? How does the business feel? And, you know, these are the kind of soft shit that, are, you know, some old people that say, oh, you can't talk about, you know, the soft. But, like, it is about, you know, what does it feel like? I always found it quite interesting when I was talking and when I was back in manufacturing, it was one of the better paid factories in Kettering, and everyone from outside the business was like, you need to get there because they pay so well, and they ended up getting a job there, luckily. And everyone that worked there never once said, you know what, we're paid so well here, but they all said, you know, when I started working here, we used to get hampers at Christmas with a turkey and a beef joint or a whatever, and two bottles of wine, one red and one white, but we don't get that anymore. And I think silly little things like that can affect your culture. And like you said, it's not a safety culture, it's a business culture, and safety is one part of that.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, as that starts getting bad taste in people's mouths when they don't get their sort of leg of lamb for Easter. And yeah, and then that bad feeling starts creeping into other areas, don't it? And then it sort of spreads throughout the business. And yeah, that's when you've sort of lost everyone, and it takes a lot to bring that back. And I think that's quite an old school sort of approach, isn't it? Giving people a hamper at Christmas and sort of other like points throughout the year. And yeah, you don't see that much in new companies. Or when sort of go into a company, you get the odd thing, Christmas bonus potentially. But yeah, that sort of old school approach where you sort of go at the pub every Friday with the boss, or sort of at Christmas time, they'd bring like a few bottles of wine in, sort of have a drink, finish at 12 and have a drink. Mm. That's sort of, I don't think that's around as much anymore. Just it's due to the pressures of the workplace now, isn't it? It's a totally different place to be.
I suppose you mentioned it earlier about kind of like dissemination of information when we were talking about staff highlighting stuff back to you. So I suppose that brings us back to like information, instruction and training, which again obviously is a massive thing. It's specifically referenced in the regulations, specifically mentioned in the guidance, and actually it's kind of a crucial cog in the machine of creating safety, I suppose. So how do you work that? Because I suppose noise is quite big for you, but I suppose in some areas, say let's say for example construction, you know, it might be a handful of specific tasks, for example, as part of a wider construction site, and maybe your experience in construction might help. Noise might be one part of their risk assessment or their training, for example. So, you know, how do you do it now in manufacturing? Do you have a noise specific training session or information instruction, whatever? But then in comparison to maybe other industries where they might have noise rolled into an overall safety induction, I don't know, I'm thinking out loud.
So what we do currently, it's part of the induction. People are sort of explained the noisy areas, what they need to be wearing in certain areas. And also how to put the earplugs in properly, which, like you said earlier, is very important. Otherwise, you might as well not be wearing them. I think we said earlier, communication is difficult. And getting that information, instruction, training out is sort of a big part of a safety professional's job, isn't it? So we've got SOPs for everything, and they sort of touch on the... got a front page, which is pretty much site rules or factory rules. So they're ran through, they're regularly reviewed as well. So once they're updated, they're sort of briefed out. We've got a training department that do that across all the shifts. Like you said, updating those SOPs is easy, but rolling out to 300 plus people is a bit more of a sort of time constraint. Yeah, definitely. So we've got the committee as well. So getting information out through them is quite easy as well. We have them monthly meetings. So we display information in the canteen as well. We've got health and safety board. That's obviously the most popular board in the canteen. we can put sort of information up on that as we need it to. We've also got weekly and monthly newsletters that go out there. And we have to be putting safety messages each month. So if we're sort of noticing a trend with regards to noise or PPE not being worn, or we're changing something, they're quite well received as well, those newsletters. People do sort of come up and read them and sort of take on board what's said. So we put messages in there as well.
Nice.
And going through the management team as well, the factory management team, so giving them the information they need to pass on to their guys, or to know what to look out for when they're working in the factory, is important as well. Not just from a sort of compliance point of view, but from their sort of confidence point of view. They know that if they get a query from someone in the factory, they've got the right information to give them back, or can point them in the right direction if needed.
So it's kind of like that, again, it's that multi-tonged approach, isn't it?
You know, definitely.
It's not one magic wand. I just found as well, for me, it was when, again, probably everything I kind of do, is I try to think that every opportunity as a safety professional, every opportunity is an opportunity. I'm messing up my own slogan here. Every kind of meeting, visit, conversation is an opportunity for education, I always found. So every conversation with everyone in the business is an opportunity to, let's say we're talking about noise, is to, you know, say, do you know what the lower exposure limit is for noise? Nah, I just, you know, wear earplugs like I'm told to, because the blue sign over there says wear it. Well, actually, it's 80 decibels. Finish conversation. Don't go to any more in depth. Just leave it there. Boom. You've dropped the number, but you've had an opportunity for education, I suppose. You could probably call that coaching. A colleague of mine calls it coaching whilst walking, which I think is a nice title, a nice buzzword. But that I found was quite important. You know, and from anything with your meetings with the senior management team all the way down for, you know, walking around the shop floor and stuff like that.
Yeah, definitely. Like I said earlier, I like talking about safety, and sort of a big part of the job is breaking down legislation, so it's understandable for people that don't have time to spend an hour reading through three specific regulations and trying to decipher what they say. So getting information, sort of ingesting it and sort of spitting out stuff that's useful for not just sort of senior managers and the sort of board of the company, but the guys on the shop floor can understand and use as well, is very important. When you're saying there about coaching by walking around, that reminds me of do you remember Dilbert, the cartoon? It's like the work. Gilbert. Have you seen him? It's a work cartoon. It's like, my dad had the books years ago, and it's like, it was a cartoon as well. Brilliant. I think Scott Adams that does it, does them. But there's one, I've got a boss on it who is going on about sort of managing by walking around. And he said that he's walked to the far side of the parking lot, as American, the car park and back, and he's not seen any improvement. So that coach by walking around reminded me of that. But yeah, that's definitely what I do, sort of out on the shop floor. I think having your sort of colleagues see you out on the shop floor and sort of paying interest in what they're doing, mm-hmm. and not just being sort of holed up in the office, which is sort of outside the factory and across the car park from them. So sort of seeing that I'm out there and interested in what's happening to them day to day, I think is sort of, hopefully they're taking on board that I care, and not just think that I'm checking up on them. Because I think if you're in this job and you don't sort of care, it's you're not going to get very far in it. And it's not like it's a brand new sort of theory that I care, I want people to go home safe at the end of the day. That should just be sort of obvious that everyone wants that. I don't want anyone to go in there and sort of lose a finger. Not just for the paperwork that it caused me, but just from a sort of moral perspective as well. But yeah, I think sort of showing that you do care and sort of giving them time as well, because a lot of shop floor workers probably won't get time in their off sort of senior managers or the management team throughout the day. So sort of showing that you do care about what they've got to say, and like you're saying, acting if they are raising something that's relevant, is important. And if it's not relevant, explain to them why. It's like, that's not a big issue. You could deal with that yourself. You're sort of empowered as well as an employee to do something in that situation. So yeah, just giving people time. That's what I like to do. Go out, talk about safety. Go out and not talk about safety with people as well. Sort of build relationships. It's all good. Yeah, all this while you're both wearing sort of ear defenders and you're shouting at each other across a noisy line,
adding more noise.
Yeah, just constantly being noisy.
Oh, nice one. I'm conscious that we've been talking a long time. I suppose when you get two safety professionals talking about safety, they tend to waffle.
Just a bit, yeah. Yeah,
conscious. I do need to go make breakfast for my wife and myself, so
I think I might pop over.
I don't. We've only got two slices of bacon, mate. So it's not going to happen. I
think
we're going to fight over that, let alone anyone else. I think we've covered a hell of a lot of stuff there over quite a niche area. But I think it's been a cracking conversation, Stephen. Thank you.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it. Thanks for having me. Keep up the great work. Really enjoyed the podcast.
Thanks for listening, guys. I hope you found that useful. Stephen brings a hell of a lot of very specific high-level experience and examples for us to listen to and take away. Obviously, your industries will vary quite a lot, and you might have nowhere near that amount of high-level noise to deal with. But there's some tips and tricks in there and some conversations and some examples for you to take away and manage noise at work in your workplace. As per usual, if there's something you want to hear from us, there's something you missed or any questions about today's podcast, hit us up on Twitter at RiskFluent. Come find me on LinkedIn, James McPherson, or find RiskFluent on Facebook /RiskFluent. Okay, so as promised, next we've got some bonus material here where me and Stephen got off on a little bit of a tangent towards the end of the podcast before saying bye about diversity in safety. Essentially, it's just a little bit of tongue-in-cheek, but also, you know, it's a kind of advertisement for everyone out there. If you're listening to this and, you know, and you're thinking about a career in safety, come along. You know, we need more diversity. We need more different cultures. We need people of color. We need people. We need ladies. We need just much more diversity. But anyway, well, I won't give away the conversation too much. Let's get into this bonus material.
Like you said, two people talking about safety, fantastic. But yeah, just listening to sort of someone who's, I think you're on the same similar sort of wavelength to me,
yeah,
going by a sort of conversation we're having and listening to you. So yeah, that stereotype of the sort of middle-aged white man with his clipboard, the shiny shoes, his hard hat on,
yeah
I think dispelling that myth is very important these days, especially when you've got two hip,
it's like, do you know what I mean, they're so boring. I've had enough of seeing old white men. Like, I'm hopefully, fingers crossed, I'm waiting for a confirmation of a date, but I'm hopefully going to a local school in a few months to talk about health and safety. How
excellent.
It's not what you think it is. It's actually a really interesting career.
Yeah,
come and do it. But not so much trying to convince you. I'm essentially begging you to join the industry because I'm fed up of talking to the same old white men. Like,
yeah.
We need women. We need people of different race and, you know, minorities and so everything. Yeah, because they all
definitely
bring their own ideas from their own cultures, their own everything. And that's what we need. We need more ideas. You know, I'm fed up with the same old crap. It's not, you know, we've got us to a real good position. You know, we've dropped, I think I mentioned it in the Health and Safety at Work podcast, where we dropped fatalities at work so much since Health and Safety at Work Act come in, but we've plateaued now.
For
me, that means we need new ideas.
Yeah,
we need new people, new way of thinking, and we're not going to get that if we keep getting the same old crap. Some bloke who's been an engineer for 30 years and now wants a nice tidy retirement in health and safety for 5-10 years and then he's going to retire. Nah, I've had enough of it.
Yeah,
and also like having it as a career for me as well. Like, people don't see it as a first career. I quite like IOSH's apprenticeship they started doing last year. Having apprenticeships in safety, trying to convince my boss to think about something like that. And I love that. I think that'll be interesting as well.
Yeah,
but I think we're getting off tangent. I think we'll definitely have you back on the podcast, Stephen, and probably talk about a career in health and safety maybe. Very good. I need to go get some breakfast. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, guys. Hope you enjoyed that bonus material. Catch you next week. Bye.